Tantor Audio presents JFK Has Been Shot by Charles A. Crenshaw, M.D., with Jens Hansen and J. Gary Shaw. Narrated by James C. Lewis. Why this book was written. I told my friend, the writer Jens Hansen, that I believe the Warren Commission report to be a fable, a virtual insult to the intelligence of the American people. He asked me if I'd ever considered letting someone help me write a book on the subject. I explained to him that we doctors who had worked on President Kennedy, whether out of respect or out of fear, had agreed not to publish what we'd seen, heard, and felt. Jens looked at me and said, "I know you've heard this a million times, and I don't want to sound like I'm preaching, but the American people have a right to know exactly what went on in Trauma Room 1 and exactly what you saw. Moreover, they have the right to know that their government was changed, that the course of history was dramatically altered in 1963 through a conspiracy to assassinate the President of the United States." Foreword. Introduction. When the government engages in an official inquiry into a matter of extreme public concern, the government is obligated in good faith to search for truth without fear or favor and report its findings to the people. Pursuant to this self-evident truth, the Warren Commission, WC, failed in its attempt to engage in a thorough, comprehensive, and professional investigation into all aspects of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. One of the central reasons for its abject shortcomings was that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, its primary responsible investigative agency, had, prior to the WC investigation, already concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman and had acted without foreign intervention. The resulting WC alleged investigation was a sham, a charade that short-circuited a legitimate probe. Credible witnesses with vital evidence that contradicted the preconceived FBI conclusion were ignored. Dr. Charles Crenshaw's book demonstrates this critical failure. It gives credence to the public perception that the WC report was less than sincere in fulfilling its mission. Moreover, because of the overwhelming impact that the assassination had on our country, coupled with the WC faux investigation, overall government credibility suffered a stunning blow. I offer the following to suggest how and why it happened. Analysis, discussion. The Kennedy assassination was a colossal outrage. It fractured our fundamental belief in the orderly process of our political institutions. Camelot was shattered, and with it all of its politically inspired romantic imagery vanished. Its portrayal of a neo-idealism of truthful, just government analyses and pronouncements, constitutional equality, merit-based advancement and transparency of process, disappeared. The gut-wrenching events of November 22, 1963, in Dallas's Daley Plaza paralyzed the nation. It was a political and personal catastrophe. We lost our president. Shortly thereafter, within weeks, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover proclaimed that the assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, acted alone, without foreign intervention. Case closed. The government sought closure. The people demanded truth. Portents of a winter of despair were about to dawn. Over the years, the Kennedy assassination has receded into mythology and has become, like the tales of the Old West and the lives of secular saints such as Washington and Lincoln, fair game for the fabulist, the moralist, and the entertainer. Libraries have been filled with books offering vying theories. Some have been in support of the WC, some indignantly opposed. All postulate with passionate certainty the righteousness of their cause. To be sure, some treatises rise to the level of admirable scholarship. The most outstanding and valuable of these are narrations by the authors who actually played a significant role in the historical events. Dr. Charles Crenshaw, a renowned surgeon with an acclaimed expertise in treating trauma victims, attended to President Kennedy in the emergency room inside Parkland Memorial Hospital, just moments after the fatal bullets blasted through the president's head, causing his death. JFK has been shot, recounts in vivid detail those tempestuous, spellbinding, percipient first-hand observations, analyses, and medical procedures undertaken to try and save Kennedy's life. Dr. Crenshaw documented these events with a medical precision that memorialized an evidentiary foundation, revealing tracks of bullets' entries and exits, passing into and out of Kennedy's body, and the condition of Kennedy's head wounds. Dr. Crenshaw's participation inside Trauma Room 1 made him an important witness in the truth-finding process. Yet this doctor and some of his colleagues who offered emergency care to the president and whose observations were corroborated and memorialized in writings and diagrams were never called to give testimony to the WC. In his book, Dr. Crenshaw informs us as to the testimony and substance that he would have tendered. Most notably, based upon his expert findings, were his conclusions that the fatal shots which killed Kennedy entered the president's head and body from the geographical right and front area, the grassy knoll, and not from the rear, the Texas School Book Depository building. Certainly, Dr. Crenshaw's expert testimony would have put into question the WC findings by contradicting its central theme that Oswald shot the president from the rear as the motorcade passed the depository building. This extraordinary WC omission and failure to chronicle accurately the assassination events appears in other relevant areas as well. In so doing, the WC created a fog of deception that has substantially called into question its authenticity and credibility. Why would the commission not call Dr. Crenshaw, a highly credible expert whose opinions were invaluable in its alleged search for truth? And why did the commission ignore trustworthy evidence and render conclusions to buttress a false narrative? Certainly, if the WC was engaged in a virtuous search for truth, then there is no rational reason to omit Dr. Crenshaw and his corroborating evidence from the official record. However, if the WC was a facade devoid of investigative legitimacy, designed to tailor its faux investigation to a predetermined conclusion, then one readily accepts the reality of its deception. The people expected a straightforward, fact-finding foray leading to historical truth. Instead, it was given a Lewis Carroll through-the-looking-glass fantasy form of due process. First the sentence, then the trial. And if the accused is thereafter found not guilty, all the better, says the Queen. In early 1977, I was deputy chief counsel to the Congressional Committee investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. During the course of my probe, I came into possession of a memo dated November 23, 1963, from J. Edgar Hoover to all Bureau supervisory personnel. It stated, inter alia in substance, that the FBI agents who had questioned Lee Harvey Oswald for approximately 17 hours immediately after Oswald's arrest had listened to a taped conversation between an individual who identified himself as Lee Oswald and an individual in the Cuban embassy. The conversation originated inside the Russian embassy in Mexico City by this faux Oswald, who telephoned the Cuban embassy. The call was made on or about October 1, 1963, just about 7 weeks before the assassination. The Hoover memo noted that the agents categorically concluded that the voice on the tape was not that of Lee Harvey Oswald. Based upon the evidence adduced during the investigation, I had reason to believe that David Phillips, the third-ranking member of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, in charge of Western Hemispheric operations, employed a nom de guerre, Maurice Bishop. Bishop had significant involvement with anti-Castro Cubans and Lee Harvey Oswald. I had Phillips subpoenaed to appear before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, HSCA, in executive session. I asked him under oath where we could locate the tape of the so-called Oswald conversation of October 1, 1963, while inside the Russian embassy in Mexico City. Phillips stated that it was CIA policy at the time to recycle the tapes every 6 or 7 days, and it was no longer in existence after the first week in October 1963. I then handed him the Hoover memo, which, according to the FBI director, clearly revealed that the tape was evidently available in Dallas on November 22 and 23, 1963. Phillips read the memo, then folded it, placed it in his jacket pocket, arose, and walked out of the hearing. I immediately urged the committee to recall Phillips and advise him to obtain legal counsel so that he could be given an opportunity to purge potential criminal charges of contempt and perjury. Also, there were many more questions that he needed to answer. I further advised the committee of the urgency of the matter and gave them legal options. They chose to do nothing. Thereafter, our staff phones were denied long-distance telephone access. Franking privileges, free mail service, were withdrawn, and staffers' pay was withheld. Prior to my assignment with the Congressional Committee, I served as an Assistant District Attorney, ADA, in the New York County District Attorney's Office under legendary DA Frank Hogan. While there, I tried hundreds of cases to verdict. I was bureau chief of the criminal courts, ran the homicide bureau, and was in charge of the training program for the legal staff. From experiences as a prosecutor, I knew well that there is no political way to investigate a case, there is no liberal or conservative way to gather evidence, and there is no Democrat or Republican way to evaluate it. Unfortunately, the Congressional Committee played politics with our investigation and subverted it. The members breached the trust reposed in them by the American people. They assured me that whatever the facts revealed would be forthrightly presented to the public. Regrettably, that was false. Also, equally distressing, contrary to the credible facts, the WC made conclusive findings that Lee Harvey Oswald made that telephone call on October 1, 1963, in Mexico City, inside the Russian embassy, to the Cuban embassy. It, too, breached its duty to engage in an unconditional effort to report historical truth. For many reasons, the WC investigation was flawed. Dr. Crenshaw's book presents the case for shots fired from the grassy knoll area, situated in front and to the right of the president. Dr. Crenshaw offers his expert opinion with persuasive corroborating evidence. He memorialized it contemporaneously with his findings, as was his custom when treating victims of trauma. Yet, he was not called to give testimony before the Warren Commission. Listen to this truly thrilling, dramatically inspired, page-turning account of the Kennedy assassination, and be enriched with critically important historical truth. Lest we fail to understand the state of mind of the WC commissioners and investigators, I offer this classic, documented exchange between WC Commissioner Allen Dulles and Chief Justice Earl Warren of the U.S. Supreme Court. On or about the third week of January 1964, Wagoner Carr, the Attorney General of Texas, Dallas D.A. Henry Wade, and Leon Jaworski, the Chief Counsel to Wagoner Carr, met with Chief Justice Warren in executive session. They informed him that from an unimpeachable source, their description, Lee Harvey Oswald was a contract employee of both the CIA and the FBI. The Chief Justice responded with an assurance that the information would be followed up with a fair inquiry. "Not so fast," interjected Allen Dulles. The Chief Justice asked Dulles to explain. Dulles then stated in substance, "Well, if you ask J. Edgar Hoover if Oswald ever worked for the FBI, he will simply say no. After all, you know that he is already upset with us because he had early on concluded that Oswald was the lone gunman." The Chief Justice inquired, "You mean that if I were to call an agent here as a witness under oath, he would lie?" "Yes, if he were a good agent," said Dulles. "Then who will tell the truth?" asked the Chief Justice. "Maybe, the President," replied Dulles. Sadly, the WC treated this matter just as it did Dr. Crenshaw. It did nothing. Robert K. Tannenbaum, March 2013. Introduction. My name is Charles A. Crenshaw. I've been a surgeon for 30 years. Throughout my career, I have watched thousands of gurneys slam through swinging doors of emergency rooms, carrying the old and the young, the rich and the poor, the broken and the dying. Without exception, every time I have walked into an emergency room, I've encountered a victim of some unexpected calamity, the course of his life abruptly, sometimes permanently, interrupted. Terror, fear, remorse, shock, anger, and disbelief are but a few of the emotions that characterize trauma patients and their families. Helping these people is my business. Trauma is ignored by most people, especially the young and rich, who have no concept of life-threatening measures when they are well, when life is going their way. As the greatest killer of America's youth, trauma viciously and ruthlessly takes lives by stealth. Every day, each of us is exposed to myriad conditions that can subject us to severe injury, whether it be from automobile accident, a fall on the ice, an injury in a sporting event, or a knifing or shooting. Trauma is not respectful of age, race, sex, occupation, or status. Over the years, the faces of the many victims I've treated have blended into an indistinct, obscure visage of pain, fear, and death. After so many cases, all my trauma patients seem as one, except for two, John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald. The assassination of President Kennedy, the wounding of Governor Connally, and the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald were, in medical terms, classic cases of devastating trauma, specifically hemorrhagic shock caused by profuse bleeding. One moment, the president and governor were riding in a motorcade through downtown Dallas on a beautiful, sunny day, waving happily to the crowd. Only minutes later, they were at Parkland Hospital, mortally wounded, fighting for their lives. It was sudden. It was unexpected. And it was life-altering. As for Oswald, he believed that he was securely in the custody of the Dallas Police Department. Then, in a fraction of a second, he felt a sharp pain in his abdomen, and the American people had witnessed their first ever murder, live on their television sets. Enormous damage was done to these men by the bullets that ripped through their bodies. The entire right hemisphere of President Kennedy's brain was obliterated. Almost every organ in Oswald's abdomen was ravaged, and Governor Connally almost died from the missile that traversed his chest, arm, and leg. Trauma can attack psychologically as well as physically. When it does, its effects can be paralyzing and long-lasting. Today, the families of assassination victims, the citizens of Dallas, the medical personnel at Parkland Hospital, and those of us who remember still feel the sting and the reverberations from the hail of gunfire that lasted for only a few seconds that fall day in 1963. Compared with other events and incidents in my life, treating the President of the United States as he lay fatally wounded and then operating on the man who allegedly shot him is like matching a magnificent ocean against an insignificant pond. Never in my wildest imagination did I consider that, as a resident surgeon at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, on that fateful November day, 1963, I would experience the most poignant moments of my entire life. Ironically, feverishly struggling to save the dim spark of life remaining in President Kennedy's dying body was only the beginning of a harrowing weekend that ultimately introduced me to a level of discretion we seldom discover, one that I've had to practice to protect my medical career and possibly my life. Southwestern Medical School, Parkland Hospital, and the U.S. government have never been overly subtle about the desire for us doctors to keep quiet and not divulge what we heard, saw, and felt that November weekend in 1963. From the time President Kennedy was wheeled into the emergency room until the recent filming in Dallas of Oliver Stone's movie JFK, The doctors who witnessed President Kennedy's death have always felt the necessity to continue what has evolved over the years as a conspiracy of silence. Just recently, a gag order was issued from Southwestern Medical School warning those doctors still on staff there not to confer with Oliver Stone about President Kennedy's condition when he was brought into Parkland, despite the fact that President Kennedy was neurologically dead when he was taken from his limousine. Both Parkland Hospital and Southwestern Medical School, partners in academic medicine, will always be defensive about losing the most important patient they had ever had. Through the years, there have been 1,000 instances when I wanted to shout to the world that the wounds to Kennedy's head and throat that I examined were caused by bullets that struck him from the front, not the back, as the public has been led to believe. Instinctively, I have reached for the telephone many times to call a television station to set the record straight when I heard someone confidently claim that Oswald was the lone gunman from the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository, only to restrain myself. Until now. The hundreds of similar cases involving gunshots that I've seen and treated since 1963 have further convinced me that my conclusions about President Kennedy's wounds were correct. I know trauma, especially to the head. To this day, I do not understand why the Warren Commission did not interview every doctor in President Kennedy's room. The men on that commission heard exactly what they wanted to hear, or what they were instructed to hear, and then reported what they wanted to report, or what they were instructed to report. Had I been allowed to testify, I would have told them that there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that the bullet that killed President Kennedy was shot from the grassy knoll area. I would also have informed the Warren Commission about the call I received from Lyndon Johnson while we were operating on Lee Harvey Oswald. President Johnson told me that a man in the operating room would get a deathbed confession from Oswald. The incident confounded logic. Why the President of the United States would get personally involved in the investigation of the assassination, or why he would take the inquest out of the hands of the Texas authorities, was perplexing. Not until 2 years ago did I seriously consider writing a book on this subject. While I was attending an open house at a friend's home in Fort Worth, I was visiting with my friend, Jens Hansen, a writer who was completing his first book. We had previously discussed the assassination of President Kennedy and the other events of that weekend, but this discussion was more intense. We were speculating as to the long-term effects of President Kennedy's death. I told him that I believed the Warren Report to be a fable, a virtual insult to the intelligence of the American people. Having read almost every book that's been published on Kennedy's death, in addition to having had an intense personal experience with the case, I considered myself one of only a few men who could make that claim. He asked me if I ever considered letting someone help me write a book on the subject. I explained to him that we doctors who had worked on President Kennedy, whether out of respect or out of fear, had agreed not to publish what we'd seen, heard, and felt. It was as if we were above that, as if what we knew was sacred, as if to come forward with our account would in some way desecrate our profession. To a degree, I think we were afraid of criticism, and if one of us started talking, the others would have gotten into the act, and sooner or later the finger-pointing would have begun. Jens looked at me and said, "I know you've heard this a million times, and I don't want to sound like I'm preaching, but the American people have a right to know exactly what went on in Trauma Room 1 and exactly what you saw. Moreover, they have the right to know that their government was changed, that the course of history was dramatically altered in 1963 through a conspiracy to assassinate the President of the United States. You, above all other people, saw and experienced more that weekend than any other person at Parkland Hospital. Every critical event and important moment involved you. If you go to your grave with this information, if you do not publish it, the people who did this to me and to you and to every other American will be that much more protected. as a witness to one of the United States' most significant events, you have a responsibility and a duty to record what you know. By doing so, there will have been at least one person who was there who will have helped expose the greatest lie of our time. This is your chance to do something very meaningful with your life, something so important that it outweighs your 30 years as a physician. I promise you this, he said, smiling. Eventually, one of your fellow doctors will break ranks and talk. It's inevitable, and it might as well be you. You may be correct, I replied. I've heard that appeal about a million times, but not quite as convincingly as you just put it. I'll think about it. For more than a year, his words echoed in my mind. Since 1963, people had encouraged me to write about my knowledge of John F. Kennedy's death, but never before had I seriously considered doing so. Night after night, in a dreaded rendezvous with the past, I graphically relived every moment of that weekend in 1963 in morbid detail. More often than not, I awakened in the dead of the evening in a cold sweat, trying to drive away the gruesome images that were becoming clearer and more disturbing as time went on. I was having a recurring image. In slow-motion memory, I walked by Jacqueline Kennedy, who was bloodstained and distraught, as I entered Trauma Room 1. As I approached, Dr. Jim Carrico and Dr. Malcolm Perry were feverishly working on President Kennedy. Beginning at his feet, I remembered every hair, mole, and wrinkle in the president's body. With each successive image, the bullet hole in his neck bubbling blood and parts of the president's brain dangling from his skull increasingly took on more dimension and color. His struggle to breathe and the fading sounds of his failing heart tormented me. Drops of his blood hitting the kick bucket beneath the gurney told the remaining seconds of President Kennedy's life, as the voices of Dr. Charles Baxter and Dr. Kemp Clark echoed those eternal words of doom. Looking into the somber faces of Dr. Malcolm Perry, Dr. Robert McClellan, and Dr. Ronald Jones, as we all accepted the inevitable, then embracing Jacqueline Kennedy as Dr. Charles Baxter tenderly told her that her husband was dead, recomposed within me the emotional tenor of those terrible moments. I relived the tactics of intimidation practiced by the Secret Service agents. The men in suits, as we referred to them, struck fear into Parkland's personnel as the agents went about providing more protection and concern for a dead president than they had shown for a living president. I followed the heavily armed agents as their entourage surrounding the casket escorted President Kennedy's body out of Parkland Hospital, their arrogance almost palpable. Jacqueline Kennedy walked alongside, her hand resting on the coffin. As the months passed, I continued to read and study every available publication on the subject, increasingly becoming more and more outraged at the great lie that was being perpetrated. For the first time, I questioned whether I had actually entered into a contract with the other doctors to not write my story. I hadn't taken an oath or signed an agreement to that effect. All I had done was fail to object openly to the edict of secrecy proclaimed in Trauma Room 1 by Dr. Charles Baxter, professor of surgery and director of the emergency room, just after President Kennedy died. Silence cannot be taken to mean tacit approval. Finally, on November 17, 1990, while sitting at my desk at Peter Smith Hospital, after reviewing the mounting evidence and my recurring memories one last time, I decided to tell my story. I realized that the compulsion to chronicle my account of that fateful weekend at Parkland Hospital in 1963 had begun to grow within me almost immediately after the assassination. I knew I had to speak out, if for no other reason because the democratic process created by the greatest constitutional document ever written was being callously and maliciously circumvented by a handful of cowards. My silence has protected them. The choice of the American people was cast aside with one squeeze of a trigger. The work of men like James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, Benjamin Franklin, and the sacrifice of the millions who have defended the Constitution were rendered impotent by a few sorry criminals. Efforts to suppress and distort the truth about the assassination on the part of government officials and agents, as well as certain representatives of the media, have been well documented in previous works on this subject. That these efforts included threats, intimidation, falsification, and destruction of evidence, and even death.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?